The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record. Medicine and sickness heal each other. A pointer. A clear-eyed person has no nest. Sometimes on the summit of the solitary peak, weeds grow in profusion. Sometimes they're naked and free in the bustling marketplace. Suddenly they appear as an angry titan with three heads and six arms. And then again, a single atom, they manifest all physical forms. To save people, according to their type, they mix with mud and water. If suddenly they release an opening upwards, not even the Buddha's eye could see them. Even if 1,000 sages appeared, they too would have to fall back 3,000 miles. Is there anyone with the same attainment and same realization? To test, I cite this old case. Master Yunmen, teaching his Sangha, said, "Medicine and sickness heal each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself?" The verse, the whole earth is medicine. Why have ancients and moderns been so mistaken? I don't make the carriage behind closed doors. The road through is naturally quiet and empty. Wrong, wrong. Though they be as high as the sky, your nostrils have still been pierced. Good afternoon. As we are on our last full day of this session, and I wanted to first just sing the praises of spring. Served seasons, and where we earn spring. You know, every... at the end of every winter, when all the snow is melted and the land just looks ravaged, like it's been through something, as it has. And I think, impossible, it can never come back. It just looks devastated, you know. And then the miracle begins. And there's something about looking at the buds, or maybe anything that's born or hatched from an egg or springs from a bud, that when it first begins to appear, it's got such a primordial, primeval, ancient look about it. You know, it's all folded in and squishy, and it's like, how could this ever become? It looks almost like a creature, you know? And particularly at this time, like every day you can go out and just watch. You can watch it happening right before your eyes. In this pointer, he really has a lot to say, and I think inspired by Master Yunmen and this koan. In a way, this koan is... kind of has the essence, holds the essence of all of Buddha Dharma. It's really saying it all. It's very few words. Medicine and sickness subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? And it's interesting, it's always interesting to look and see what these old masters would say in the pointers, in the verse, what they would pull out, what they would point towards. And here really makes a point of this clear-eyed person who has no nest, who in one moment is like a fierce titan, three heads and six arms, and the next moment, sun-faced, moon-faced Buddha, all embracing mercy, mixing with mud and water in order to be able to respond to each person according to their need, manifesting all forms. And of course, the question that this pointer is asking is, who is this person? Is there anyone? he says at the end, with the same attainment, the same realization, and what he's really saying is the same nature. Who is such a person? You know, we always need to remember that whatever the teaching, no matter how immediate or how distant, it's always talking about this. What is yourself? It always comes down to this. This person, this time, this life. In the commentary, Wanwu says, do all of you have a way to get out? Of course, out of samsara. Same way of saying, do all of you have a way of getting in? And the great effort that we enter into in this path is how to ultimately do that without taking a single step, right? We're ready to go travel miles and miles, climb mountains, scale walls, tear down walls. We like demolition, right? But actually, in the end, it's how to do all that is needed without taking a step, without raising a finger. The Buddha said, from the point of view of our delusion, of our self-clinging, we see the world in terms of I am this is me, this is mine, my identity, what I possess. But at the same time that we're manifesting that in our mind, consciously or otherwise, we're also saying, I am this is the same as saying I am not this. This is me is the same thing as saying that is not me. This is mine is the same as saying that is not mine. So it's not just about what I bring in and identify as myself, but it's also what I disidentify with, or I not even disidentify, but I anti-identify with, maybe is more accurate. What are the potential threats? What do I keep outside of the gate? It's a life of boundaries. It's a life of control. It's a life of, as the Buddha said, ultimately failure. It doesn't work. The Buddha said it rather unequivocally on numerous occasions. He says, this will never succeed. I think of that in terms of this, our ongoing age of authoritarianism. And I've always wondered, you know, looking back in history and now not looking back at all, like why would people support, go to, want, choose a dictator? Like, what is that? And I was thinking of that in terms of a life of boundaries, a life of threats. And that within change, particularly when change is very pronounced, Karen Armstrong wrote a book on fundamentalism, and she talked about how in every age throughout the centuries, when there has been a lot of change, like in the time of the Buddha, there were certain strains of fundamentalism, religious fundamental and political dogmatic views that came forward in response to that change, fear of that change. And there's always these themes. It's always hearkening to go back to some better, perfect time, make it great again. That, of course, never existed. That time never existed. The loss of something, the sense of the loss of something, and then the grasping, and then the need to create boundaries, to dictate, to control. And that even at the loss of one's own liberties, one's own freedoms, that would be chosen, is being chosen. So Yunmen says medicine and sickness. And here, think of medicine and sickness as every polarity, everything that stands in opposition to something else, which is pretty much anything that appears has its opposite, has something that stands in front of it, against it, having, not having, wanting, not wanting, progressing, regressing, success and failure, gain and loss, The Buddha said, all conditioned existence is dukkha. All existence that arises as a result of a coming together of different forces, which is everything. That's why Nagarjuna said, that is essentially the mark of emptiness. The fact that nothing exists by itself is just another way of saying nothing exists inherently. All conditioned existence is dukkha is another way of saying all conditioned existence is nirvana. Medicine and sickness heal each other. How is that? In the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, the Buddha said, seated augustly and unmovingly, the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's vision, and the Buddha's body is right here. Which is another way of saying this wisdom that is not fixed, that has no static form, this vision and body that is not fixed, that has no static form. That's why it has to be a living tradition. We have to be engaged in a living tradition. And what does that mean? We have to be living. We have to not be fixed. We have to not be static. We have to not become dogmatic in our mind. And the Buddha was very onto this. He said that the pleasure of intellect and the pleasure of intellectual ideas is very intoxicating. And we have to be alert to that. And the Buddha said, it's just that hidden within the kleshas. Greed, anger, and delusion. This Buddha wisdom, Buddha vision, and Buddha body seems to be veiled. And though we find ourselves within all of these kleshas, there is a Tathagatagarbha, there is a Buddha nature that is always unsullied, always present and clear and replete with virtues, no different from the Buddha's own. And so think of all of the virtues that Buddhism teaches, the six paramitas, the affirmative aspect of all the precepts, all of the qualities that we bring forth in the four immeasurables. What the Buddha is saying is all of these already exist within us. We all come fully endowed. But it's as though they are hidden, dampened, obscured, held behind a wall. But when we try to extricate them, eradicate the negative things, control, dominate, the illness, wipe out the kleshas, the illness increases. Why is that? It's like seeing something that seems to have its own power that is doing something to us, even if it's my own mind, my own thoughts, my own emotions. Seeing that solidity, that sense of sovereignty, when we attack it, when we try and dominate it, when we try and get away from it, we're basically in our mind adding more solidity to it. I remember when I was young, my grandparents had given us a small twin four-poster bed that I had. And I remember one night waking up, and there was a shroud, a veil. Somebody had a cloak on their head, and they were standing right in front of the window with the moon shining. And I was like, I was looking at it. And the more I looked at it, the more scared I got. And finally, I turned on the light, and I realized it was just my clothes that I'd thrown over one of the posts. And then my brother calls over, "Turn off the light." But it's like the longer we proliferate, the larger it gets. In the commentary, it says, medicine and sickness subdue each other. This is just an ordinary proposition. It's just a true statement. If you cling to existence, then the teacher speaks of non-existence for you. If you're attached to non-existence, emptiness, then the teacher speaks of existence for you. If you're attached to neither existence nor non-existence, then they manifest the 16-foot body of the Buddha within a pile of shit and garbage, appearing and disappearing. medicine and sickness. There is suffering. The Buddha began, right? Why didn't he start by saying, everything is perfect and complete. Enlightenment is wonderful. My view is radiant and clear. Why did he begin by saying all conditioned existence is suffering? Because that was the real truth for the students he was speaking to. That's where we begin. So there's no denial of that suffering. Buddha Dharma never denies that, but it does ask us to come closer and say, okay, now acknowledging its existence, what kind of existence does it have? Master Linji said, when you have a thought of doubt in your mind, it's as though you're obstructed by the element of the earth. When you have a thought of desire in your mind, it's as though you're drowning in the water element. When there's anger in your mind, you're being burned by the fire element. And when you have joy in your mind, you're being blown about by the element of wind. He said, when we really understand this clearly, we'll no longer be tossed about by circumstances. Instead, you can use them wherever you go. You can appear in the east and vanish in the west, appear in the south and vanish in the north, appear in the center and vanish at the border, appear at the border and vanish in the center. You can walk on water as though it's land, walk on the land as though it's water. These are considered six earth shakings that represent the free working of an awakened mind. But then Linji says, but why is it that you can do all of these things? Because you realize that the four elements are like dreams, like illusions. All those things that are appearing before us in the forms of earth, air, fire, and water ultimately have a dream-like nature. They're not fixed. They're not dogmas. They're not something that is happening to us. They have a reality. They should not be ignored or denied. Sometimes they have to be attended to, improved, stopped. But the essence, the source of our suffering is not happening out there. But if that's true, then why do they hurt so much? Why do they hurt so much? Why do we get so bound up if all are like illusory dreams and clouds? And so we enter into practice, and at the very, what's the, you know, after you're welcomed, the very first thing you receive is really the most powerful. It's sort of like you walk in, it's like, this is great, I'm checking this out, somebody welcomes you at the door, and then you're zapped by lightning. Right? Instruction in Zazen. And if we actually understood the revolution that has just begun, we would probably run away. You know, so as I said to somebody this week, you know, when it's particularly difficult, just remember, I asked for this. Right? This is what I asked for, right? Yeah, this is what I asked for. Because we do forget. And so Buddhism says that when we experience those challenges that always have an emotional aspect, an affect, something is happening here in the body, in the mind, energy. We give names to all of those different weather patterns that pass through us. We can identify this is grief, this is anger, this is sadness, this is loneliness. How can we do that? Because they have different qualities, they have different characteristics. And we can locate them in the body. They are located here. We are feeling it. It has a power. And so Buddhism says that is a secondary factor. It's true. It's a secondary factor. And we need to learn how to meet that in an appropriate way. What we often do is we get too fixated on that. All the while, there is a primary condition, a primary factor, and that's the kleshas. That's what the Buddha is speaking about here. that's the veil, sort of the wall that seems to be guarding Buddha nature and not letting it come out. And that's basically the emotional motivation, our greed, anger, delusion, our pride, these elemental forces that are universally human and that give rise to what we think, what we say, and what we do, which gives rise to those secondary conditions, the result, what we call our anger, our sadness, our joy, our grief, our sorrow, and that what we're trying to do is get to the root so that we're not just constantly dealing with, you know, the waves that are coming out on the surface of the water, which is necessary because that actually has a calming effect. Because that's what we're bumping up against. And so we have to meet that and learn how to do that well. And in that way, that wave is not only addressed, but the water, the depth underneath is being addressed. That's how we're sort of reaching into those deeper underlying aspects of our consciousness. And so we have to learn how to make contact with the illness, with the sickness. We come just wanting the medicine. Give me the medicine. I want to feel right. I want to be healed. Heal me. And it's like, okay, taste the poison. Make contact with the illness. It's like, no, that's not what I want. And the Dharma says, yes, that is what you want. You may not yet know it. That is the only way. And that requires then a whole symphony of skillful means. In a sense, there is one way. We have to encounter intimately that illness to see its actual nature so that it ceases to be, this is not me, this is not mine. That's why, you know, to really engage in practice, we have to be in some measure willing to take responsibility. Without that, we really kind of can't do this. Right? And just probably wouldn't, not for long. Because otherwise we will just continually be turning the light out. And that can be very difficult to do when there are external conditions that are clearly have a significant role in our own unhappiness and our own suffering. And unjustly so. And so sometimes it takes longer in addressing that, in addressing those secondary conditions, before we can begin to see more of what's going on. And so we have to learn how to make contact with the illness and make contact within wisdom. You know, I said earlier, if we want to realize peace, we have to be peaceful. If we want to cultivate compassion, we cultivate that with compassion. Now, that compassion doesn't always look the way we expect it to. And so how, when you're angry and you're actually taking responsibility for the anger, you're practicing it as Dharma, that may not feel like compassion, but that's what it looks like actually in that moment. And so to make contact, form in the skandhas, sensation, there is contact. Before the perception, before the naming, before the identifying, before we figure out what this is and figure out whether we want to subdue it or get away from it, before that. So that's what we're cultivating in our meditation, the ability to do that. We have inherently a natural ability to do that, but it becomes inaccessible to us in a sense because of the restlessness, the agitation, the kleshas. And so that's why we have to put in all of that effort, many, many hours of effort of applying ourselves, not just in Zazen, but throughout the day, particularly during Sesshin, to be addressing that so we can actually begin to tolerate, hold, forbear. You know, patience paramita has that element of forbearance. Sometimes you just have to bear what is difficult. And you are really doing the best you can. You are practicing well. And that which you are practicing is still there. It's still got energy. It's not yielding. And now you just have to bear it. That's not a bad thing. It's a real thing. It's a living thing. It's a reality kind of thing. And so part of what we're developing is the capacity to do that, but not just endure and hating it, but endure within an actual state of peacefulness because we're not fighting. It may not feel peaceful because that secondary condition, that experience is so encompassing. And sometimes it overwhelms us, so sometimes we get overwhelmed. That's honest. Right? It's also not over, right? You don't get overwhelmed forever, right? It's just... And when we do immediately rush towards perception and mental formations, what the skandhas are so profoundly teaching, and we're judging, and we're fortifying, or we're numbing, whatever we're doing, it's not over. So wherever we can open our eye, whatever stable ground we can find, whatever measure of practice we can bring to it, that's what you do. And in that moment, just let that be enough. Because that's what you can do. And that's just a moment. But in that, you are affecting the conditions, the change, the mind, the kleshas, in ways that, again, we very often cannot recognize but are happening. The commentary says, right now, this whole great earth is a profuse array of myriad forms, sentient beings and insentient beings, up to and including your own self. At once, it's medicine. At such a time, what do you call yourself? Where do you find yourself? What division has been established? What is you and what is not you? If you only call it medicine, then even by the time Maitreya Buddha is born, you still won't have seen Yunmen, even in your dreams. Perceive the meaning on the hook. Don't get stuck by the zero point on the scale. If you've got a scale that's broken, that's fixed, it doesn't matter what you put on the pan, it will give you a reading, right? It will give you, like they say, you know, if your watch is broken, it's always right twice a day, right? And so that's kind of what delusion does, right? That when we're confused, it's not that we don't have a view, we have lots of view. It's just not a right view, it's not a right understanding, it's not in alignment with what's actually happening, but there's plenty of information there. And so what he's saying is if we only see it as medicine, if medicine becomes the dogma, if medicine becomes the formula, then he says, we'll never meet you, man, which really means we'll never meet ourselves. They heal each other. They cannot stand alone. We cannot realize enlightenment without delusion. I mean, think about that. We cannot realize enlightenment without delusion. Enlightenment doesn't exist by itself. And what that means is the illness, our delusion, in all the myriad forms, as he said, right at this moment, the whole earth is presenting itself in a profuse array of myriad forms. Those are the medicine by which we realize the nature of our illness. And it can be very challenging to trust that when you just want to be free of the suffering, when you just want this to be gone. And it's not abstract. The suffering is real. It's painful. It has consequences. And so, forbearance, to have patience, to bear what is difficult to bear while on the path. I mean, I think pretty much if we're not really cultivating that, we just are. We're not going to be able to continue. Right? There's a certain moment. It's just there's going to be something easier and much more available to you, and you have your own supplies of those. Right? We all do. It's like the precepts. Sometimes people, you know, they kind of shyly say they like to receive the precepts, but they really need to wait until essentially they don't need them anymore, right? Then they'll take the vows. I said, no, it doesn't really work like that. It's like, I'll see you when Maitreya comes, right? That's why the precepts are there. That's why they are so generously offered to us. So that in the moment of anger, in the moment of greed, in the moment of intoxication, we can practice. We can realize that that is not fixed. There's nothing fixed about it. It is moving. It is alive. And that's why he says a clear-eyed person has no nest. The essence of practice is to practice non-abiding, not dwelling. I said earlier in the week, the path of a non-attachment. We're on the path of non-attachment, of non-abiding, not seeking that place of fixedness where it's like, okay, now I don't have to be aware anymore. I don't have to think anymore. I don't have to discern anymore. It's just follow the script. I mean, think about it. Why are these very superficial, patently false slogans so seductive? Because if you just believe in it, by God, right, a whole world is given to you. And all the complications are made clear. Just destroy them. Figure out who the enemy is. Hate them. Master Dogen says, well, so when sickness arises, we have to practice that sickness. That's the mandate, if you will, the commitment. That's in a sense what we are pledging to do. That you come into the Zendo, you know, when you go into an interview and you say, my name is and my practice is, that's so that you know that you have a practice and the teacher knows you have a practice. And sometimes people actually come in and say, I don't know what my practice is. Or my practice is this and this and this and this and this and this. And so that's in a sense all you know when you come in to sit. There's no agenda, there's no plan, there's no I'm going to work on this and this and then I'm going to organize that and then I'm going to work that out, right? I already know what the reality of this moment is. I don't actually. Find out. Have no nest, and you will see. That is a result. Whatever arises is a result of causing conditions. That's the urgency. That's the most authentic thing, because you didn't ask for it. You didn't decide, this is what I should work on, right? Your ego was involved in the creation of it, yes. But not in the moment of its arising. You didn't decide, I am going to suddenly have a smell that I had when I was at the lake in 1984 with my family. You know those moments, it's like, where did that come from? But you didn't decide that. Or you didn't decide to respond to this sensation with this emotion. And because of that, it's got an authenticity, an honesty. That's what we should be practicing. That's what's asking to be practiced. It's calling to us, it's saying, here, here, see? No, you're looking over there. Here, see? Master Dogen said, one who does not step forward cannot accept the Buddha's teaching. If you don't bend, you will forever float along in birth and death. If we don't heed appropriate advice, the Dharma, the teachings, then real virtue cannot be realized. In a way, it's such a simple teaching, simple instruction, right? And it was, in a sense, what it's saying is not just trust the Dharma, trust your mind. Trust your mind to have the intelligence within its delusion, within that veil of kleshas, to present to you what you can actually practice right now and shift. Shantideva says, if on account of my own actions I don't practice trusting the Dharma now, then I myself have created the obstacle when the grounds for real change have been presented, when the real opportunity for passage, for release, for insight, for liberation, I myself have created the obstacle if I don't practice and have trust in the Dharma now. You don't have to like it. Isn't that wonderful? You don't have to like it. Right? It frees you of that. You don't even have to understand it. How about them apples? There are all kinds of understanding. There's understanding why you can see the connection of this with that. You can trace it back, but sometimes you can't. I remember going into Doksan one time during session, just in a complete turmoil, emotional turmoil, just coming apart. And I went in and I don't know what I said. I don't know if it was coherent at all. And Dada Roshi just looked at me and he said, is it inside or outside? And I said, it's not outside. We don't even have to understand it. When we practice it, when we don't turn away, when we don't try and dominate it or subdue it or numb it or distract ourselves, when we practice it to the best of our ability, that is your understanding made manifest. In that moment, you have understanding. It may not be conscious to you. It may not be something you could express. Isn't that marvelous? Right? That you are relying on your training, and your training is there. And, you know, we want to know why. Why is this happening? Why is this happening? Somebody says something that hurts us. A teacher, a senior, did they mean to do that? Is that for my practice? Or were they just being a jerk? Right? If it's for my practice, well, then I will try and practice. If it's not, well, asshole. You know? About that, Shantideva says, if an adversary in your mind does not deserve respect because their intention was not that you cultivate the way, that you accomplish, practice patient, that you clarify yourself, then why should you respect the Dharma? It has no intention. It's not trying to do something for you. If an adversary is not respected because their intention is actually to cause harm, then why else would I have patience for them? In other words, he says in another place, how can I develop patience unless there are those in my life who cause me to get angry, to become irritated, to be annoyed, to lose my patience? How else am I going to learn patience? unless I have those encounters. And so in that way, when we unwittingly, it's not that you should go around and try and make everybody miserable. You don't need to. We're all pretty good at it in our own ways, even with our best intentions. We irritate each other. We annoy each other without even knowing it. How many people have irritated you this week and they don't even know it? Right? How many graves have you dug? How many, you know, soliloquies have you, you know, that just nailed them? And what he's saying is, turn the light around. What's more important? That you dominate, that we subdue, that we are right, or that we are free? And so he says, patience only arises in dependence on the causes. Those causes. Medicine arises out of the causes of healing. The cause of healing is that we are sick. That is the necessary condition for us to heal ourselves. And so he says we should respect then that adversary. We should respect our inner adversaries. To have respect for our delusion, it doesn't mean to, you know, propagate it. It doesn't mean to like ignore it. It means to recognize that there is an intelligence in our delusion. Right? It doesn't just come from nowhere. It comes out of our efforts to actually try and be in this life in a way that is in some measure satisfying. But without adequate tools and guidance, it's very hard to find our way. And so we'll use whatever's at hand and we'll learn from who's ever at hand, and that's what they've done. And that's what their examples did, and their examples. And yet, we have all had enough encounters in life with people, with situations, with ourselves, that we are here. In the poem when he says, I don't make the carriage, the great vehicle that carries us across, I don't make that carriage behind closed doors. The Buddha said his entire life he taught with an open hand. He talked about the tight-fisted teacher who doesn't open their hand, doesn't reveal, doesn't release the Dharma. That's really one of the basic meanings of the precept on withholding. To not share what we have that is ours to share with someone that would help them. This vehicle is not made behind closed doors. It's all out in the open. And that's part of the function of this. Is that even within our silence, we are practicing together, we are falling down together, we are standing up together, we are losing faith and regaining that faith together, having doubts and insecurities and returning to our confidence, persevering, all of that. You know, I said earlier in the week a thought that had come to me one day sitting in this very hall when I was sitting at the bottom of a very, very deep pit. And I remember thinking, I can't be the only person who's ever been here. I can't be the only one who's ever faced this, right? I'm not that special. And that was comforting. To have a glimpse of that universal aspect of my own situation, right? I'm not alone in this. Others have been here, many others have to have been before me, and they found a way through. That was actually what I thought. Not just that I've got company in the bottom of this pit, but actually that they found a way through, because I don't see them here, actually. So that means they found a way in. And I thought, I can too. I may not know exactly how in this moment, but I can too. Why not? I'm just this. They were just this. All the way back, just this. Dogen in the Genjo Koan says, thus, if you practice and realize the Buddha way, when you encounter one Dharma and practice that Dharma, you complete that Dharma. You realize it as whole. Medicine, sickness have healed each other. When you encounter one action, practice that action. Since the place is here, the place in which that takes place is here, and the way leads everywhere, the reason that the limits of the knowable are unknowable is simply that our knowledge arises with and practices with the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma. That in every moment, what we can know is limited, he says in another passage, by the extent of our penetrating vision, simply by the extent of our ability to see and understand. That's it. And that is what is completely unfixed. That is what is being affected, expanded upon, developed, strengthened, cultivated, made spacious, realized when we practice. And so that even as we are encountering the limit of what we know, we are at that very same moment permeated by the unknowable. In this moment when the way may seem very limited, when my the qualities of what I need to draw upon my resources may seem very limited, I am in the very same moment present to a vast, unlimited amount of resource that I just have not yet tapped into, opened the door to. So we have this evening and tomorrow, let's really, you know, it's really important to, particularly as we get to the end of Sesshin, because we're all conditioned, you know, time, beginning, middle, end, and that we very sort of impulsively, habitually start looking for the next thing. So think about what Sesshin is about, right? It's practicing your life now, right? Tomorrow will come when tomorrow is now, right? Trust that. And so to really try and practice with that kind of quality, that integrity all the way through, right? So that you're just, you don't know it's the last day, right? It's just now. You're just practicing now. That's what matters. And what excellent training that is for every day. So let's sort of take up all that we have inside of us through this week and just let that flow us through.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.